Is everybody feeling warm and cuddly out there? It's lovely weather. Well, crowd in and keep each other warm. These cards that I think you've had passed out to you are even more for, if you want to get, we have a weekly email newsletter which talks about all these kinds of issues every week. It's free. It goes all over the world. About 1,000 new people are signing up per month, and you can get that just by filling out a card, and that won't cost you a thing. So that's just to stay connected. A couple other logistical things. One is, if you haven't signed yet the Christian Declaration Against War in Iraq, please do so. There are people here holding up that pink. I think they came, they had, what, 3 signature sheets, and now they've got 1,500 names or so already have signed it. I really encourage you to sign that. I say it every seminar. The British voice now is the most important voice in the world on this question. And if the British people and churches could just persuade Mr. Blair to just say no to Mr. Bush, it could stop. It really could stop this war in Iraq. We're going to talk about nonviolence today. This is a third of 3 seminars. A Global God was first. How September 11th could change the world. The second was A Global God, a better way to fight terrorism. And this one is going to be the possibilities of nonviolence in our world, especially in the Middle East. And this is for, it's a good topic for this. You know, the last day, people are trickling away, the remnants here in the cold, windy weather here. So it's a good day to talk about nonviolent civil disobedience and direct action. I talked briefly in another seminar about an action we did in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol. Nonviolent direct action and civil disobedience. In response to a domestic issue, this was the President Clinton's signing of a very bad welfare bill, bad for poor people. Republicans and Democrats both signed it. And so 55 urban pastors went, and we read from Isaiah, "Woe to you legislators who pass infamous laws and deny my people of their rights." Read from Isaiah, we prayed, we sang songs in all in our clerical costumes and garb in the rotunda of the Capitol. And of course, the police moved in. And I always like to do things in the rotunda because the sergeant at arms always gives you the call to worship. On the bullhorn, he says, "It is illegal to pray in the rotunda of the Capitol." And that's all these sort of agitating Christians need to just pray harder and stronger and longer, you know. So, but what was really kind of dear was that there was a crowd of 8th grade middle school students who happened to be in the rotunda. The rotunda is that, if you've seen the Capitol pictures, it's the big dome building in the middle of our houses of parliament, you might say. The big dome building is the Capitol Rotunda. So we're right there very dramatically in the rotunda. And these kids are there on a civics lesson, you know, learning about American government. And here's all these clergy and church people and urban workers there in a circle praying and singing. And the police moved in and began to arrest us, handcuff us, and take us off to jail. And it takes a lot to make 8th grade kids speechless, you know. But it worked. They just were wide-eyed, eyes as big as saucers, and they just were watching everything and didn't say a word, and they watched each of the people handcuffed and taken away. And at the end, the 8th graders broke out into applause. They began to clap, you know. The New York Times was there, and it went up to one of the young students and said, "What did you learn today about government, about democracy?" And this young man said, "I learned that sometimes you just have to stand up for what you believe. And when you do, it's good to have some people with you." And I thought that was a good lesson about this whole notion of nonviolent civil disobedience. It's good to have some people with you. And the weather here really reminded me of another story that really taught me a lot about what this really means. It was years ago, I think 1978, a long time ago, in the middle of the whole nuclear arms race, a number of us went to a place outside Denver, Colorado, the Rocky Flats Nuclear Weapons Facility. This is where they made the triggers, the plutonium triggers, for every single nuclear warhead in the U.S. And so these trains would come in carrying the plutonium. And they really were very symbolic, almost modern death trains. And so we went there to hold this vigil and rally. Then about 100 of us walked onto the tracks to camp there and stop those trains. Well, all was going well until a quick weather change, like we've just had here at Greenbelt, turned a warm, sunny day into a terribly cold and blustery day, and it began to rain and then sleet, and it pelted down, and it was freezing cold. And the doctors came out to say, you're all going to get hypothermia, you have to leave, you have to, but a few of us foolish people stayed all the night. And I had never had a colder night in my life. And that night, I had these very vivid images in my mind, pictures of soldiers over all the years being out like that, camping and out in the weather and the rough and the rain and the cold, being uncomfortable, being miserable, being at risk, being wounded, and even giving their lives for causes that they believed in or thought they did, or somehow they got drafted and there they were. And the price that soldiers pay to wage war is often so much more than the price that we pay, those of us who believe we are peacemakers. And that night in the freezing rain and cold, which was, you know, really a temporary inconvenience, is all it really was, I began to think about the cost of peacemaking. What it would mean to wage peace with the energy and commitment and willingness to sacrifice with which so many have done so to wage war, discipline, sacrifice, willingness to suffer. Daniel Berrigan, a Jesuit priest and a good friend, elder, mentor of mine, says, because we want peace with half a heart and half a life and will, the war, of course, continues because the waging of war by its nature is total, but the waging of peace by our own cowardice is partial. So a whole will and a whole heart and a whole national life bent toward war prevail over, he says, the mere desire for peace. The mere desire for peace. Human conflict is inevitable, I believe. Any serious notion of peacemaking must be based on a realistic assessment of our human condition and not on elusive notions of human perfectibility and utopian dreams where there will be no conflict. The question is, as we have conflict between individuals and groups and families and tribes and nations, how will that conflict be prevented, be reduced, be halted, be overcome? The issue is what to do with inevitable human conflict. And while that conflict is inevitable, that I think war is not. The most decorated soldier in Vietnam, an American Marine Colonel David Hackworth, says this about modern warfare. War machines, this is a war hero in the U.S., war machines have gotten so horrendous in terms of the destructive capability. Weapons of war have become geometrically so horrendous and so destructive that there are no winners. Then you look at the cost of one cruise missile, and we use hundreds of them in the Gulf. $1 million, the cost of one bomber, a B-2, $1 billion, he finally concludes, we can't afford the toys of war. Gandhi said, I object to violence because when it appears to do good, the good is only temporary, and the evil it does is so permanent. What does it mean to be peacemakers? I want to suggest a criteria, a way to think about nonviolence, something I hope you can keep in mind, a way to evaluate nonviolence. I would say it this way. Nonviolence, to be credible, to be credible, must answer the questions that violence claims to answer, but do so in a better way. Nonviolence must not say, those are not the questions. That's not a problem. Saddam Hussein isn't a problem. That's just a myth of Washington. It's not a myth of Washington. I'm saying a war with Saddam is the wrong way to respond to a very real threat imposed by this brutal dictator and somebody who would use weapons of mass destruction, has and will again. How do we deal with him? In a better way. Nonviolence must answer the questions that violence claims to answer, but in a better way. Peacemaking, secondly, will have casualties. They say, oh, well, nonviolence. Well, there were casualties. War has casualties. And they don't say, because this war had casualties, it was ineffective. Nonviolence and peacemaking also may have casualties. It certainly involves risk. In Nicaragua, we did something called the Witness for Peace. Some Americans were down in the northern part of Nicaragua. The U.S. was waging a war through a mercenary force called the Contras. It was really a terrorist war against civilians. And some of our church folks went down and entered a town called Jalapa. And while they were there in that town, the mortar firing every day on that town, the mortar stopped. The U.S. mercenaries stopped firing mortar shells into Jalapa because they heard there were Americans in the town. And the people of Jalapa said, come back. It's great when you're here. Come back. So 300 more went back, and the same thing happened. So that promoted this idea of, we called it Witness for Peace. We sent 5,000 people to Nicaragua into the war zones where the fighting was most intense, and they were literally buffers. They were, while they were there, they did useful things, but their presence is what made all the difference. And not just their presence in Nicaragua, but 5,000 people then came home and became the best spokespeople, best advocates, best information sources on what was really happening in Nicaragua. Like the Middle East today, we weren't getting the story about what was really happening in Nicaragua until 5,000, mostly church folks, came home, and 5,000 sort of news agencies sprung up around the country, and it began to turn the nation around. That's the power of nonviolence. It tells the truth, and people can listen to a different perspective. I'll never forget, I was in Cleveland, Ohio, for a Pentecost service, and I was on that first team that went to Nicaragua after we organized this to the war zones in Jalapa, and so I was chair of the board, so I commissioned many of these teams as they went off, and I was doing that in Cleveland, one had just come back, and so I was meeting with this team before preaching that night, and I got a phone call from Washington, from the office back home, from Sojourners. And the message was bad. The Contras had attacked a town called Ocotal in the northern frontier, and many people had been wounded and killed. The bodies were lying in the front yard of the Mary Knoll Sisters, wonderful American church women who were there, and they called, and they were just terrified. And so I got the call, and I put the phone down and shared the news with that circle of American Christians of this terrible attack on Ocotal. And I watched as I saw tears coming down their faces. And I was startled by the depth of their emotion until they told me that's where they had been, Ocotal. They had just come home. They had prayed with the people. They had played with the children. They had shared meals together. And now they are wondering, are our friends all right? They wept and we prayed. We held hands and prayed for Nicaraguans by name. And I knew at that moment the war in Nicaragua would soon be over, because American Christians were praying by name for its victims. Because after that prayer and after those tears, they just leapt out of that room to the phones, the newspapers, the radio stations. And by the next morning, Cleveland knew what was happening in Ocotal. And when the U.S. Congress finally voted to stop the funding for the Contra War, to end that war, in the morning, the U.S. State Department blamed the churches for the funding being stopped. And we were glad to take credit for that policy change. Nonviolence can indeed change things. And now, as we turn to the Middle East, we know that it must. I believe that the extremes on both sides in the Middle East would find it a great nightmare, if a nonviolence campaign began to grow and grow and grow in that desperate land today. Jeff Halper was just here on the stage. Jeff is one of the real, in my view, one of the heroes of that nonviolent struggle, a peacemaker, a Jewish peacemaker, an Israeli peacemaker in Palestine. I was in the Middle East about a year ago. I hadn't been there for a while, and as I came in from the airport in Tel Aviv, I looked around and I saw on every hill, I saw these huge new housing developments. I hadn't been there when I was there last. Settlements, Israeli settlements on every hill, overlooking every valley, small Palestinian towns, first world living conditions they are, on top of the hills, towering over much poorer Palestinian villages down there in the valleys. Settlements became facts on the ground, as Mr. Sharon now calls them. He was the architect of the settlement policy long before being prime minister. Those facts on the ground are an obstacle to peace. Many American Jews are settlers now in Israel, and you see this scene of an SUV pulling up alongside a Palestinian family, been there for 10 generations, an American Jewish settler from New York City, been there for 2 weeks, shouts at the Palestinian family, "Get out of this land, God gave it to us. We've come from New York to take it." 10 generations of Palestinian tradition. The soldiers there, the Israeli Defense Forces, are everywhere, but they aren't there to keep law and order or protect everybody from crime. They're there to protect the settlements and the settlers. The more I was there, the more it reminded me of South Africa. I'd been to South Africa so many times. It did feel like, and Jeff has said this, it did feel like the beginnings of a Bantustan kind of scheme, a new apartheid. And Rabbi Michael Lerner from my country, from the U.S., the editor of Tikkun magazine, courageous rabbi, willing to speak up on these questions. Michael said, this is a great way to understand the sort of settlement policy in the West Bank Gaza. He said, well, the Oslo document, it was like, you know, the sort of so-called peace settlement. It's like they said, okay, we'll give you back your house now. They said to the Palestinians, we'll give you back your house now. Of course, we will still control the hallways in your house and all the rooms between the bedrooms, and we'll control the bathroom. There is no contiguous territory that is Palestinian. There is no Palestinian state possible with those settlements. There is nothing but endless checkpoints through which Palestinians have to move every single day. Can't go to school, can't go to work, can't go see your mom, can't go visit your boyfriend, your girlfriend. The best commentator on the settlement policy is an Israeli, a journalist named Amira Haas. She tells me she's obsessed with the settlement policy, what she calls, in fact, others call closure. I'm obsessed with closure. She calls it the theft of spontaneity. You can't be spontaneous anymore if you're a Palestinian. You can't say, today I want to see a sunset. Today I want to go to the beach. Today I want to visit my mother. In South Africa, if you were an activist, you had the real prospect of being pulled out of bed in the middle of the night and imprisoned, tortured, even killed at a moment's notice. But if you were an ordinary South African, not too involved in politics, you were poor, you were under an oppressive apartheid regime, but you still could go out with your mates and play some football in the afternoon. You still could have visited your family, you could go to school, such as they were. I was there with a South African activist, now in the government of the ANC, and he said, we never faced anything quite like this, even in South Africa. Now, if you've been to some of Jeff Halper's seminars, you've heard about this. I want to suggest that a movement for nonviolence has to deal directly settlements, occupation. The West Bank and Gaza are occupied territory. In the media reports in the U.S., when they talk about terrorist violence attacks against settlements, they never say what they always say on BBC. This attack took place in occupied territory. It's an occupation. Settlements designed to prevent a just peace solution. Whatever we do, this nonviolence campaign must focus on settlements and occupation. I think movements are responsible for the images they project. Let me say what I mean by that. When the Israeli military shot and killed 12-year-old Mohammed Dura in his father's arms as they cowered in fear against a wall in Gaza about a year ago. You remember that picture? You remember that scene? Little 12-year-old boy. That image went around the world powerfully. Little Mohammed, cut down. I was at that intersection just several months later. I was at that place and saw that wall. He'd taken his son out of school that day because he was afraid he might throw stones with the other boys. He didn't want his son hurt. They took him with him, Mohammed's father did, to look for, he says, I want to look for a used car. Come help me pick out a family car. And they went to look for a car. He didn't really want to buy a car. He wanted the boy to be out of danger. And they were just walking home when the military opened fire. He cowered with his boy against a wall. His boy was shot and killed, and he was paralyzed for life. That image went around the world, but 3 days later, two Israeli soldiers, now we know undercover soldiers, were captured and lynched by an angry Palestinian mob in the city of Ramallah. And the image flashed around the world quickly, that of bloody hands raised by angry Palestinians over lynched soldiers' mutilated bodies. When I was in Jerusalem, speaking to my Palestinian friends, my allies, my brothers and sisters, I said, movements are responsible for the images they create. If the images that had come out of Selma and Birmingham in the American South during the Civil Rights Movement, if they had included dead cops, we would have lost that struggle. We have to look at what kind of images we are creating. That's why I'm so grateful for, as Jeff has said, groups like the Christian Peacemaker Team in Hebron, mostly Canadian and American, usually Mennonites, Church of the Brethren, Quakers, they go for periods of time, and they accompany the people. Hebron is a place where there are many clashes because the Israeli settlement is right inside the Palestinian town, always looking, it seems, for a confrontation. And here are these peacemakers just accompanying. And one day, there were a large crowd of Muslims going to worship in the mosque, and the Israeli soldiers tried to stop them and turn them back from worship, and they refused, and they went to their knees to pray. The soldiers trained their rifles and were going to open fire until a 23-year-old Canadian Mennonite woman rushed out in the center and said, "Stop, stop, stop. These people are unarmed. Do not fire." And they didn't. And they put her in jail overnight. But she came back and she said she walked the streets. It was like being welcomed as Jesus Christ back into this little town. Small groups of people can make a great difference. Margaret Mead, the great American anthropologist, said, "Don't think small groups of people can't change the world." She said, "They're the only ones who ever do." Who ever do. What does it mean to create a movement in which we take responsibility for our images? How to focus on a strategy that deals with settlements and occupation? Any successful movement for nonviolence will have to be Christian and Muslim and Jewish, all three. Now, there is a cost to pay. Michael Lerner, my rabbi friend in Berkeley, California, a Zionist website has put up his name with horrible words about him, and they've even named his address and given directions to how to find his house. His wife, Deborah, and Michael have been terrified sometimes by the phone calls that they get. He's a rabbi. He believes in the state of Israel. He wants an Israeli state to be free and secure, and he wants it not to destroy Judaism in the process. And he's a fighter for Palestinian human rights. Jeremy Milgram, Rabbis for Human Rights. There are courageous groups. The good news we don't hear is there are groups on the ground, on the West Bank, in Gaza, already beginning a movement for nonviolence. Nonviolent civil disobedience, nonviolent resistance. We think nonviolence can't make a difference, but when we withdraw our support, as we've seen the Danes did it against the Nazis in South Africa, it wasn't finally the armed wing of the ANC that made the difference. It was a movement around the world for sanctions that Wembley Stadium held great rallies here, and we did back in Washington. We had civil disobedience every day at the South African embassy. It was that sanctions campaign that broke the back of apartheid. Finally, your government agreed to sanctions. In the end, my government had to as well, and when my government finally did, because of a nonviolent campaign, the next day they began negotiating with Nelson Mandela in his prison cell. Nonviolence has a better chance of changing injustice than our continual, habitual resort to military solutions on every side. There is no symmetry of violence in the Middle East. The overwhelming violence is on the side of the Israelis. Any observer would have to say that. Yet, for mothers and fathers who lose their children, either in a suicide bombing in a disco or a military response to that bombing, destroying an apartment building full of, yes, a terrorist leader and women and children who they knew were there, mothers and fathers weep over the death of their children and don't care about things like symmetry. I said all week here that terrorism is the deliberate taking of innocent lives, whether by individuals or groups or states. There are terrorist states. My country has been one over and over again. But we must draw the line. Despite politics, despite injury, despite grievance, despite suffering, we must draw the line and say there must be no toleration for terrorism, no matter who commits it, on any side. Only that kind of movement for nonviolence willing to suffer the cost of that position will succeed. I love the truthfulness and the courage of people like Hanan Ashwari, who says, "Why And when did we allow a few from our midst to interpret Israeli militant attacks on innocent Palestinian lives as license to do the same to their civilians? Where are those voices and forces that should have stood up for the sanctity of innocent lives, theirs and ours, instead of allowing the horror of our own suffering to silence us? Says Palestinian leader Hanan Ashwari. Strategic nonviolence is not about being nice to your oppressor. It's about dissolving the foundations of their power. Non-cooperation, boycotts, strikes, sit-ins, accompaniment, small groups, large groups. I think the time has come for something new, not just criticizing our governments, but for us, citizens, ordinary people, people of faith, people of goodwill, Christian, Jewish, and Muslim, to begin to speak of a campaign, a movement for nonviolence in the Middle East, in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Britain, in the U.S. You can't call for nonviolence there and not yourself commit to it here in your own country. Such a parallel movement for nonviolence worked in South Africa. I believe it could work here. I don't know all the answers, all the targets, all the strategies we should undertake, but we learn by doing, we learn by acting, by taking one step, and then the next step gets more clear. We have Palestinian Christian leadership. Bisharia is here. He'll be here, I think, at Peck at 4:30 this afternoon. Come back and hear him. He will be a leader in the struggle for nonviolent resistance. Jeff Halper is here. There is leadership. They need our support. I had breakfast this morning with Bishop Rhea. He says things are changing. Things are changing in Britain, in Europe. Things are changing in America. Attitudes are changing toward this struggle. Don't think that President Bush represents all American opinion on this question. Americans are uneasy about what is happening in Israel and Palestine. They have an intuitive sense that something bad, something wrong is happening to the Palestinians. But I believe it's going to be something similar to Nicaragua. Bishop Rhea said this morning, there's a back and forth, back and forth, back and forth rhythm that we have to create. In Nicaragua, we kept going back and forth for 3 or 4 or 5 years. And then when the testimony of those who had been in Nicaragua began to surface in the U.S., they had an authority to speak that no one could contradict. We have to begin going back and forth, back and forth. Amos Truss takes people back and forth, back and forth. We have to go and be present, your presence at those checkpoints. We went, we had a bus of internationals at the checkpoints, and with all the kind of international clout of all these people, we still got held up for hours. And I heard stories of women giving birth at checkpoints because they couldn't get to hospitals. I heard a story of a woman who gave birth to a child at a checkpoint and then was forced to get out of her car and stand there while she was being interrogated with her child still attached to her body and just collapsing in exhaustion, and the soldiers laughing at the woman on the ground. Most people in my country, if they saw that, would believe it was wrong, despite what my country's foreign policy is. How do we take the human reality of a situation like that and speak to it in our own culture? There's nothing like the authority of having been there and seen it before you speak. So I think the church leaders have got to be engaged. We're talking about a service at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. Talked to the bishop about that this morning. He's been there already. And then something similar on the West Bank in Gaza. Desmond Tutu used to say, when we stand in front of the bulldozers, we need some of you to stand there with us. And when the struggle in South Africa was nearing an end, when Nelson Mandela had been freed from prison, when elections were forthcoming, when the inevitable finally was here, Bishop Desmond Tutu took several international supporters who'd been there for them for all those years in South Africa. He took them to a beach, walked on the beach in South Africa, and he said two things. He said, thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you for your work, your solidarity, for your struggle. Thank you for your faith. Thank you for your commitment. But you know what? We're going to be all right now, he said. We're going to be all right now. You know the second thing Bishop Tutu said to all of South Africa's best international supporters on the beach that day? He said, now, go help the Palestinians. Go help the Palestinians. The Palestinians will lead their own struggle, and they have Israelis like Jeff Halper alongside to lead that same struggle with them for a safe and secure land for Israelis and Palestinians. But they can't do it alone. They can't do it alone. They need our standing alongside as well. I've seen Milosevic fall. I've seen Marcos fall. I've seen P.W. Botha fall. I've seen the southern governors fail in the U.S. all because of movements initiated by people of faith who believe in the possibility of nonviolence. Love your enemies, Jesus said. That may be the one of the most quoted and most ignored statements in all the Gospels. But listen carefully to what he's saying. Love your enemies as yourself, he's saying. It means to regard their security as to be as important as yours. Their well-being, their prosperity. Archbishop-elect Rowan Williams said it well. There's no security except common security. That's our simple message in the Middle East. The security of the Israelis depends not upon the Israeli Defense Forces. It depends upon Palestinians feeling secure in the same land. And our security depends finally on their security too. So I believe in nonviolence. I believe it's worked all over the world. I believe it's what Jesus calls us to. And I believe it is indeed possible in the Middle East. And now I invite your questions. Do we have a microphone? Okay. We have about 15, I left some time because this topic takes some discussion, 15, 20 minutes for questions. And I'd like you just, if you'd like to ask a question, make your way to the front. It'll get your blood going again. It'll warm you up. That's a good thing. Come to the front, and then we can talk about this for a few minutes, okay? Just make your way to the front, and maybe a little cue here for questions right up here in front. Is nonviolence possible? Even in the Middle East.
Sure. I went to the National Religious Broadcasters Convention in the States this year to do a bit of research, and there was a breakfast there hosted by the Israeli Tourist Board, and the Israeli member of the Knesset who looks after tourism came and spoke to the owners of all of the Christian radio stations, and he thanked them for the support that they were giving to Israel. And it was very much, something very much in support of Israel, the whole thing. And there didn't seem to be another side to that. Do you have a perspective on that issue, how the Christians in the States are reacting to this?
There is certainly a campaign that is being run by people like Jerry Falwell and the Christian Right in support of whatever Israel does. And in that campaign, they invoke theology, biblical prophecy, as they interpret that. I think you understand that point of view, a very bad theological attempt to give a blank check to the Israeli government. I just want to say that you hear that kind of media in this country. That doesn't represent even a majority of evangelical Christians in the U.S. certainly not the majority of Christians. In fact, we were talking this morning, there is a growing, the new bishop in Washington, Episcopal John Chain, is very committed to this question of justice for Palestinians and security for Israelis. The presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, the last one, Ed Browning, has been a champion. Patty and Ed Browning have been champions for this cause. I think the churches in the U.S. Are a place where a movement like this can grow. There will be that sort of Christian right point of view. They've got lots of money, but one of the big Christian news organization was invited by the Israeli government this year to have the American conference there. All expenses paid, hotel bills paid, come and see what's happening at the invitation of the Israeli government. And they were going to go. They said yes. This was an evangelical press association. They said yes. And the resistance, the reaction across the country from evangelical journalists and magazines was so strong, they finally rejected the invitation. So that's a real problem, but don't think that is in fact the only view, even the majority view among American Christians.
I'm sure there's a lot of people here like me who have a 9-to-5 life and they go to work and they come home. And I was wondering what you think that people like myself who don't feel they're being called to go out to other countries to do something on the ground can be doing besides writing to MPs and signing petitions. Is there something that we can actively be getting on with?
She has a 9-to-5 job and doesn't know how this applies. Well, that's a good question, because, in fact, the movements I'm talking about back home have been full of people with 9-to-5 jobs. Sometimes they take their 2-week vacations and go to Nicaragua. We went to Nicaragua for our vacations. Go to a war zone for your vacation. We offer people a great deal. You know, take 2 weeks off work, go to a war zone, mortar flying overhead, pay for it yourself. And we'll provide you, a free bus ride while you're down there, And yet 5,000 people said yeah to that. 5,000 people accepted the invitation and think it was a life-changing experience. I think we have to create the sort of mechanisms for ordinary folks leading real lives with jobs and kids to be a part of this back and forth. I think that is possible for all of us. I also think there's so much to do here. I do think that if people in our churches and in our countries really knew what was happening on the ground in the West Bank and Gaza, like, again, in South Africa or in Nicaragua, if they knew what was happening, it would change how they feel. It would change how they think. It would change how they vote. Our job is to awaken public conscience to what's happening on the ground. That's what our job has always been. And that's a job for ordinary people. You're the best person to speak to other people like you, your friends and colleagues at work and church. It's when ordinary people, church leaders, have a job to do, to provide leadership and take risks and be church leaders. But it's the ordinary grassroots people, I've been talking about this whole festival, who finally make the difference on the ground. Sometimes we think of all of this as just so, heroic and big and so much beyond me, and it's very human. I know this is a very serious topic, but sometimes you do this kind of stuff, and it's kind of funny what happens. We're at the at the Nevada nuclear test site. That's where the U.S. has their testing of nuclear weapons. I call it the dress rehearsal for the end of the world. They test all these nuclear weapons. We used to go out there every year and go onto the site and just pray. And, of course, they'd arrest you and they'd take you off to jail. We did it one year. I was out there with just a handful of people, a Franciscan provincial church leader, and I and two others walked onto the site. We got into the police car after we were arrested, and he sat in front and I was in the back. And, of course, Louis had been arrested several times before and was very... He's good friends with the sheriff here who had arrested him. So they get, chatting away, and he was a local Franciscan provincial and chatting away, and all of a sudden the sheriff says, "Oh, no, I forgot to read your rights to you." See, in the U.S., they got to read your rights to you before they put you in jail. If they don't, they can you know, be called to account in court, and you can be let out of jail. So he had forgotten, because Louis was his friend, to read his rights. So he starts saying, you know, the litany that I could repeat from memory now, I've heard it so often, you have the right to remain silent, you have a right to an attorney, and so on. Well, right in the middle of his reading the rights to Louis and I, Louis's watch, his digital watch, goes off. But it's not just an ordinary watch, it's a Mickey Mouse Club watch, and it plays the Mickey Mouse Club theme song. Da 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 da. MICKEYMOUSC. Louis got his hands cuffed. He can't turn the watch off. So Mickey Mouse is screaming in the car, and the sheriff just yells louder, "You have a right to remain silent. MICKEY. You have the right to a lawyer. MOUSC. Mickey Mouse forever. Let us hold your banner. High, 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 high." And I was just hysterical in the back seat. You know, I just lost it. Serious civil disobedience. I couldn't keep a straight face. So I wrote a column about this in Sojourners, you know. And then a few months later, Louis is getting himself arrested again at a nuclear laboratory in San Francisco. And he's handcuffed again. And he's being taken up in this elevator to jail. And the watch goes off again. And his fellow prisoner says, "Oh, yeah, you're the guy that I read about in Sojourners, you know." So you can have a lot of fun in the process of changing the world here. And ordinary people, you know, this is a very ordinary thing we're talking about here, not just for the Mandelas and the Gandhis and the Desmond Tutus. Sorry for that diversion.
I believe in nonviolence, but can you give us a perspective of how nonviolence could have worked against a regime like the Nazis in the 1940s?
There's an article in the current issue of Sojourners that I have like one or two copies of, but it's on the website, that is a response to that question in light of, it's calling for a non-violent campaign against Saddam Hussein. The author of the article says that Saddam Hussein's regime should be overthrown, but not by the American military, by 22 million Iraqis. And it talks about a whole history of nonviolent non-cooperation and the overthrowing of brutal regimes. And it challenges the notion that's implied in your question, that there are some regimes that are just too brutal and too ugly and too harsh for nonviolence to work. And the usual mythology is, the only reason Gandhi was successful in India was that you Brits are just so nice, and Gandhi just appealed to your niceness, and you just said, "Okay, we're sorry about that." It forgets the brutality of British occupation in India, terrible examples of massacres and slaughters there, and it forgets, in fact, the great success in many ways of the Danish resistance to the Nazis during that same period. He tells the story of that in this article. The Milosevic story is instructive. I think the Marco story is instructive. Rulers can't rule. All rulers rule finally, not because of the police and military, but by the cooperation of those who are ruled. If you think about it, our collaboration, our cooperation, our agreement, our going along with things is crucial for our societies to run. When, in fact, we begin to withdraw our cooperation, even small numbers but large enough to disrupt the functioning of the society, historically that kind of non-cooperation has been very effective. There's no more brutal regime than the Southern governors and the Ku Klux Klan and the enforcers of segregation in the American South. And yet it was the Montgomery bus boycott, the refusal to ride the buses, and then the sit-ins, and there was cost and consequence and imprisonment, and people lost their lives. But the withdrawal of consent is a threat, even the most brutal dictatorial regime. So check out the article, get it off the web, and he does a history there, and begins to apply it to how it might work in Iraq? It's a good question.
Your country has traditionally been a great supporter of Israel and Israeli government. How much of that support do you think is due to a perceived cultural responsibility for the Holocaust?
Oh, I think a great deal of it. That's the issue, I think, here too. That's part of the issue. There is a sense of responsibility, a sense of guilt, a sense of trying to make good on our failure before. That's why I find the Jewish voices back home to be the most courageous in some ways, taking on that. I've got Jewish rabbi friends who say, we're trying to provide some cover here for Christian prophetic witness, because the churches often are hesitant to speak for that very reason. We're afraid of being thought to be anti-Semitic. And there is in the U.S. a profound anti-Semitism. There is in Britain. There is all over the world. And so it is true that that is just under the surface. And so people begin to speak about the policies of the Israeli Defense Forces. And there are, indeed, forces in the U.S. that turn that into a kind of anti-Semitism. And so Christian leaders are afraid to speak. So some courageous rabbis have said, no, we are speaking as Jewish rabbis on behalf of Palestinians, Palestinian human rights, a fair and just solution. We want you as churches not to be silenced by either their memory of the Holocaust, which is very real and very powerful still, or the fear of sounding anti-Semitic. That's why I think our voice, the panel on September 11th, was Jewish, Christian, and Muslim that Amos Trust organized. Very important for those many voices to be heard so that we can move beyond the being silenced by past injustice. Michael Lerner said, I don't want the Holocaust to become the justification for Israel behaving in ways that are so contrary to what Judaism stands for. The Holocaust must not be used to defend the behavior of Israel when it is wrong. And he's speaking as a rabbi and speaking very courageously.
Thanks. It's very easy, I agree with you, and I agree with what you say about nonviolence, to go to Jerusalem, you see the settlements, you see the treatment of the Arab people there, and you can come home with a very jaundiced view. But I'm also very aware that perhaps there's too much of a pro-Palestinian bias in many Christian gatherings in this country. I can't speak for the States, but for here. And certainly I have a number of Messianic Jewish friends who find this very disturbing, and I agree with them that any movement for peace, which there must be and has to be perhaps based a little bit more on parity than is often the case. And you do tend to hear so much an anti-Jewish, pro-Palestinian stance that can forget the terrorism that is also there on the Palestinian side, and that it needs to be addressed more holistically than is sometimes the case in the UK.
Well, I don't know your conversation here nearly as well as I do back home. Back home, the focus is almost entirely on suicide bombers and Palestinian terrorism and the Israeli victims of that. And it's tied to the September 11th terrorism, and so the Israeli government, as you've heard Jeff Halper say, is using this, we are victims of terrorism, you are victims of terrorism too, this is our solidarity. But I agree with you that there is a certain kind of view which wants to minimize or gloss over the violence, the terrorism of suicide bombers. I think it is essential that we not do that. Michael Lerner is clear in speaking against Palestinian violence, and I am too. I said that the grieving parents don't care about politics and symmetry. They care about the death of their children. And targeting innocent civilians, including children, both sides have done this, and both sides are wrong. Both sides are wrong to target innocent civilians. That is terrorism, and we must be clear, and we must not have double standards. I for one cannot call suicide bombers who don't just take their own lives, but the lives of innocent civilians. I can't call suicide bombers martyrs, and I don't. We have to be clear about suicide bombers and clear about Israeli defense fighter jet fighter plane attacks on apartment complexes with jet planes bought by my government. So our standards have to be clear. There's a line that must not be crossed when it comes to taking of innocent life. And Christian faith and Judaism and Islam all speak against that, and we must too. We're right on time. That's a good place to end. And I want to thank you very much for all of our conversations at this festival. And if Greenbelt audiences are a barometer of where we're going, I'm going to go home very hopeful. So I thank you very much, and I'll see you around the rest of the afternoon at the bookstall at 3:15. Thanks.